chopsticks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The influence of money on politics is not new. It's been there from the very beginning, though recent events and court decisions in this country seem to have not only cemented those ties, but increased the influence that can be exerted on politicians and, by extension, policy by individuals, organizations, and businesses. It appears to many that we've reached the stage where money talks louder and with more influence than voters. This happens on both sides of the aisle and usually well behind the scenes, in the shadows, so to speak. So this hour, we're trying to bring some sunlight on this rainy day to the practice. We're joined by Jim Morrill, longtime political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Jim is in our studio, and joining us from the studios of WUNC in Durham are John Frank and Chris Crum. Mr. Frank is a political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and by extension, the Charlotte Observer. Good morning to you, John.
Thank you.
And Chris Crum is publisher of Facing South and Southern Exposure and executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies. Mr. Crum, thank you for joining us as well.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. In North Carolina, there has been an undeniable shift to the right at the state level, I suppose, which was covered recently by Bill Moyers in a documentary called State of Conflict. He alleged in that documentary that this swing to the right has been fueled by the money and influence of one very rich man, Art Pope. Now, I know we're going to probably bring up his name frequently in this conversation, and I want our listeners to know that we're working on having Mr. Pope on this program on a future broadcast. So in your minds, let me begin with Jim Moore, we'll go around the table. In your minds, is he really the power behind the throne, Jim?
Well, there's no doubt that he has contributed a lot of money to a lot of the groups that are supporting candidates and supported candidates in 2010 and 2012 in North Carolina. And I think there's little doubt that some of that money helped change the landscape of the state. A lot of that money went into legislative races. Republicans needed a relative handful of seats to win competitive districts to take control of the legislature, which they've done. And also you saw it in the Supreme Court race. I think it was either in 2012 or 2010. I forgot. Justice Newby won, and he had a lot of help from one of these so-called dark money groups.
Well, in fact, he's one of the examples that Bill Moyers used in his documentary, how the chain of money gets to up the chain and how it affects people, all the ordinary citizens. John Frank and Chris Crum, let me get your reactions to whether or not Art Pope is the power behind the throne. John.
Yeah, Jim Morrill covered this in his story last week. 46 million is the number Moyers used on his program. That's how much Art Pope's foundation has contributed to a variety of advocacy groups and think tanks that are steering North Carolina to the right. And that influence is real, and it manifests itself in very different ways. Some of these groups, for instance, do some policy research, such as the Civitas Institute here in Raleigh. They did a lot of the research and legislative kind of wonkish policy papers behind some of the legislation this year. And at the end of session, they claimed a great victory. In some of their fundraising letters, they say they were an impetus behind this push, doing a lot of the work for lawmakers, pointing out the key issues that they want them to focus on. And we saw that in a number of ways. There are a number of other groups, but definitely Art Pope's family money through his foundation has contributed a large part to not only getting Republicans to office in 2010, a key year because of redistricting, and cementing their power at least for the next decade, it appears, and then also taking that advocacy arm and helping those lawmakers get to where they need to be in passing that legislation. So he got them there, and then he helped get the legislation passed through these advocacy groups.
Hasn't this been going on for years in other various different industries, like the tobacco industry and the oil industry in Washington and also at the state level around the country, and where these influential lobbying groups or these industry groups do the work for the legislatures? They actually write the legislation and have it sponsored by a legislator and push it through. Isn't that how it's been done for years? And has it changed under Art Pope? And what's wrong with that? Chris.
Well, yeah, I think what we should really understand is, and what John and Jim have touched on, is what's unique about Art Pope's political machine is really it takes advantage of the new money and politics landscape. It has three distinct arms, which is one, the family fortune. They spent over $3 million to elect Republican candidates, just Pope and his close family. There are the conservative causes, the tens of millions of dollars that Pope's foundation, which he chairs, have channeled into advocacy. And those have been the groups that have championed the legislation that we saw moving through the legislature on voter ID, repealing the renewable energy standard that North Carolina has. Whole range of issues. Those were policy positions that were crafted and honed and pushed through advocacy by Pope's network. And then third is this new piece that's emerged, largely in the wake of the Citizens United decision, of outside spending groups, which in 2012 spent over $14 million, according to an institute analysis, record-breaking amounts of money from these groups that aren't tied to any party or candidate. So in a large sense, they have free rein. They're not beholden to those candidates or parties. Some say that they've really driven the kind of more extreme rhetoric that you see in politics because they can take a farther out stand. And Pope has really been at the center of these groups. 75% of the outside spending that was spent in 2010 with a historic shift in the legislature came from the groups backed by Art Pope. And then again in 2012, they spent another $1.5 million and were crucial to the Republican gains. And again, it's not that money in politics is anything new, and you're absolutely right. And a lot of those old players are still big players in the state. Charlotte Duke Energy, tobacco interests. Reynolds American is one of the largest political donors on the national scale to the Republican State Leadership Committee, which is profiled in the New York Times this week as a major political player at the state level. But what's really unique about Pope is that there's no other single individual in this state who orchestrates and coordinates a political network on the scale and the influence, which, of course, has only been heightened now that he has a perch in state government as the budget director in Governor McCrory's cabinet.
Jim.
Mike, to your point, a lot of the companies, a lot of the industries, like the oil industry, tobacco industry, were and are still active, but before they would do most of their political giving through what was regulated, through political action committees, which were all identifiable. I mean, you could identify the contributors to different PACs and through the PACs to the different candidates or groups. But now, since Citizens United, a lot of that money is not identified.
But we, the people of North Carolina, elected a Republican legislature and they elected a Republican governor. How much of this would have gotten done in the absence of an Art Pope or in the absence of some of these right-leaning think tanks or money organizations, simply because we elected conservative representation in the legislature and at the state level? How much of it is because of who we elected versus the people pushing people behind the scenes? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. Go ahead.
Mike, I think you have two points here. One, that this outside spending from Art Pope and his family foundation and other like-minded conservatives helped put them there, helped give them the majorities and the ability to pass this kind of legislation on a scale that we haven't seen in some time. This is the first Republican-controlled state government in entirety.
Well, that's my point. Isn't a lot of this due to pent-up frustration of 100 years of wandering in the wilderness?
Sure. They did capitalize on a very key year in 2010 and really tapped into that voter discontent. But to get that message out there about that they were the anti-Democrat, that they were the answer, that the change factor, to use a word from President Obama, it took money. It takes money to get that out in mailings, to TV ads, to get the right candidates to run. And so that helped put them there. But yes, these Republican lawmakers are bent on a lot of these same policies that these advocacy groups are pushing. What these groups do is they provide them some cover. They provide them some polling data, some research on this. It helps kind of move it along a lot faster. And that's what we've seen these last two sessions.
Even Bill Moyers in his television program, I think it was last week, where he talked about Art Pope and about the change in direction in North Carolina, using this as this state as kind of a bellwether for what may happen elsewhere, characterizes your organization, the Institute for Southern Studies, Chris, as progressive. And the Institute has focused a lot of attention on Art Pope. You have an entire website dedicated to him called Art Pope Exposed. Given your progressive slant, how can we trust what you say about him and his influence as opposed to chalking up what you say to simply a different political viewpoint?
Well, everything we do is grounded in the facts. And, you know, this is something that we've never actually seen Pope or his allies really dispute any of the central points of what we put forward, which is all based on campaign finance data, looking at the tax forms provided by the organizations, which is solidly documenting. And it's not an issue of he said, she said. It's an issue of facts about the $46 million that it spent on influence, that it's unique in the sense that it's orchestrated by one person, that we have both the advocacy arm and the election spending, that there isn't a kind of a rival organization. In other states, there may be on the progressive side ones that you see like that, but we don't see it in North Carolina.
And would you be as concerned if Art Pope was a progressive working with the Democratic legislature to push things to the left?
Well, one of the biggest investigations we did in 2008 was looking at a Democratic polling firm that was doing illegal robocalls, and our investigation led to the first fines against robocalling, illegal robocalling in the country, $100,000, which went to public schools in North Carolina. So we have a strong track record of doing bipartisan investigation. And one project people may be interested in is our project Follow NC Money, which is completely – it's based just on – which is where a lot of this research comes from, which is just pulling the State Board of Elections files, tax files, and just showing people – and what we're very clear about, this is when we looked at the last election, the $14 million that both sides were definitely escalating this arms race of especially outside money that they're trying to draw in to influence these state-level races. For whatever reasons, Republicans have been more successful. They had about a 2-to-1 spending advantage in the last election. In 2010, at the legislative level, they had a 10-to-1 spending advantage with these outside groups. And some of that, I think you're absolutely right, that they were just kind of following some of these groups were probably following the sentiment of where they thought voters were headed. But I think it's also you have to understand that it helped fuel that sentiment as well and has been critical to Republicans maintaining those majorities.
I want to hear from the two political reporters, Jim Morrill from The Observer and John Frank from the Raleigh News and Observer. the allegation was made on the Bill Moyers program, for instance, that Art Pope is pushing a conservative agenda that is far more conservative and ideologically to the right than the voters of North Carolina would have wanted for themselves. Do you think that's true?
Well, the voters elected the legislature, and so they came in with their own agenda, and there's some very conservative legislators.
Yes.
And I don't know that Art Pope is any more or less conservative than Phil Berger or some of the people controlling the Senate or the House, for that matter. So I think that the fact that these people got elected and that money helped them get elected determine the outcome that we see.
John?
There's a couple things at work here. Is one, the boundaries that which voters elect lawmakers these days are slanted to Republicans. Even Republicans will acknowledge that they did a good job. Democrats give them credit for writing
these districts.
You're talking about the redistricting
as a result of the 2010 census, which was under the control
yes.
of the Republican legislature at the time.
Correct. And so yes, these voters are electing these lawmakers, but we have to take into effect the districts by which they're elected, and so that it may not be the mandate that lawmakers claim it to be. That said, voters get a say, and in this 2014 legislative election, you raised one of the main questions we're going to face is, did the Republicans go too far? And voters will have a chance to voice their opinion on that.
Okay, we have to take a break. We're talking with John Frank, political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, his contemporary at the Observer, Jim Morrill, and Chris Crum, publisher of Facing South and Southern Exposure, executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients through all phases of a project. Details at babc.com. Well, the digital age has expanded avenues of publication for writers, meaning more opportunity to get out there in front of readers. But in some ways, it's also made it more difficult to get noticed by readers who are inundated with things to read. I mean, how do you get their attention? From a reader's perspective, given the plethora of material available, how do we identify good writers? How do would-be authors hone their craft? What do they do to make ends meet while they're waiting for success, if it ever comes? And how do they get published? We look into all of this and more with three local authors who share their stories tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, following last week's chemical spill, hundreds of thousands of West Virginians continue to live without safe running water. An update on the crisis and whether other states' water supplies are at risk.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the influence of money in politics and organizations in politics seeming to have more weight, perhaps, than voters, with Jim Morrill and John Frank, both political reporters, Jim for the Charlotte Observer, John for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Chris Crum, executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies. We've been talking a lot about Art Pope, and I hope not to spend the whole hour talking about him, but he is a powerful person. And a person who has done a very good job of organizing to get his political viewpoint across with great success. And Pat McCrory, the governor, who was a kind of a progressive mayor or viewed as such in Charlotte, has become what many view as a very conservative governor. How much of that has to do with Art Pope? How much of it has to do with his influence either in the cabinet as the budget director or with the fact that he probably helped raise a lot of money to elect Pat McCrory? Who can answer
Mike,
that?
Mike, that's a good question, and one I don't think we have a full answer to. Art Pope's position as state budget director certainly gives him a lot of sway, a lot of authority, a lot of face time with Governor McCrory to influence him in certain ways. But Art Pope is a former state lawmaker who knows state government well, knows the budget in and out. He's very interested in those fine-tuned details and how much of the budget he helps Governor McCrory craft is ideological based. I think we've yet to have a verdict on that. But he is very interested in, you know, how the state saves money, keeping its fiscal house in order. And certainly is in a position to influence Governor McCrory if he chooses to.
But I think you have to look at what's been done and what the critics complain about happening in Raleigh. A lot of the legislation, the voting law, the Medicaid decision, those emanated from the General Assembly. And Governor McCrory was in a position to receive that stuff without having initiated much of it. You know, so.
But he's not banging a drum for moderation.
Well.
No, but he's also not driving the train, that's for sure. The legislature, in particular the state Senate, drove the train this session. There was a point in that Medicaid discussion, for instance, that Governor McCrory kind of had expressed some hesitation, some concern, and the lawmakers went speeding on by. It was the
same
in a number of bills.
Is it political expediency then to go along with the legislature? Because that way he can build up some political capital for something he really might want to get done or not done later on?
I think it was a reflection partly that they had more experience than he did in Raleigh, and that Raleigh is a complicated place, and these people were on the ground. They had their agenda, and they were ready to go, and the governor was still getting used to Raleigh.
Because when I had the governor on a couple of months ago, or I guess it's a couple of weeks ago now, I don't remember actually when he was on, the very last question I asked him was about why he didn't say something about the Charlotte airport. And this is what made the news.
That made news.
All over the city was the fact that he said Charlotte should control the airport. And he never said that during the big ruckus that was going on this summer. He stayed completely out of it because he said it wasn't the state. It wasn't the state's business. Is that because of political expediency, because he was being told to shut up? What's going on there?
It's certainly politics is playing a role, not only in the airport, but some of this other stuff. For instance, on the Medicaid issue that you brought up, the legislature went so fast down that path and was so ardent in their opposition. It was an anti-Obamacare movement as much as, if not more than, the policy itself, that Governor McCrory, if he had stepped out of line, in his first month of office, that would have been, it could have set him on the wrong foot. So yes, politics is a part of all of these decisions. But on the other hand, you've heard Governor McCrory defend these policies he signed. So whether or not he led the initiative, he's defending them and he owns them now because he signed most of them.
Jim Morrill, you wrote in The Observer that the Republican agenda in this past session was, quote, in fact, many agendas. Some came from think tanks, some from the corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, some from conservative ideas that have taken root nationally, some came from business lobbyists or from partisan politics. I found that an interesting couple of sentences because in those sentences you did not mention individuals. You did not mention voters. Surely there are Republican or conservative individuals and out there and in the legislature who are pleased with the turn of events.
Well, I think for all those reasons. I mean, there are people that that are happy with what happened, you know, and there are people that agree, their constituencies, for all these policies that Republicans passed. There's also a very large constituency that we've seen through the Moral Mondays and other things that are against all these things. But, you know, it's a very divided state.
How have things changed in terms of calling the tune for the dance? In other words, prior to the Republican takeover in the legislature, who set the legislative agenda and how has it changed since their takeover in 2010? I don't know who to ask that question of, so jump in there if you want to answer it.
I think Jim could speak to this for sure. But, you know, you made a point earlier, and we ought to go back to it, is that the fact that outside interests and lobbyists in particular write legislation that makes its way into law is not a new thing. It's not something we write in every one of our stories because it's almost one of these understood things in state politics, mm-hmm. though it still comes as a surprise to many voters. And under Democratic control, we were talking about a different set of issues, but there were certainly entities that helped propel them in that direction. Republicans make the case that the outfit in Colorado, the National Council of State Legislatures, Conference of State Legislatures, excuse me, they are a liberal group. Democrats say they're unbiased, and the group itself says they're bipartisan. Nevertheless, they helped drive some legislation and provide some research and such under Democrats and still do under Republicans now if they choose to use it.
So Jim, you've covered this for years for The Observer. What would you say the difference is in how things get done in the legislature?
Well, I don't think there's a big difference. I mean, when Democrats were in charge, they had their own agenda, and some of it was driven by interest groups. I mean, they were the same lobbyist, almost virtually, person for person. They were some of the same lobbyists there 20 years ago for the Democrats that there are now with Republicans. And John's right. You know, lobbyists wrote bills for Democrats. Interest groups contributed to Democrats because money follows power. And just as Republicans are raking in money now because they're in power, Democrats did the same thing when they were in power for all those years.
There's an organization called American Legislative Exchange Council, which has had influence on policy in the state and across the country. They're sometimes referred to as ALEC. And John Frank, you've done a lot of reporting on ALEC. What is ALEC and what is their policy thrust here and around the nation?
They call themselves a bipartisan but conservative-leaning organization that promotes a free market or, quote, Jeffersonian principles, you know, those kind of policies. They're an outside group, a nonprofit, part of the so-called dark money machine that we're seeing emerge in national politics. This is a group that does not have to disclose its donors, and its donors are, in most cases, corporations. And that's what's so interesting about this group is they hold conferences and they provide model legislation for state legislatures and state lawmakers to introduce, but we don't know necessarily where that comes from. The legislation is drafted by
How do we know that corporations are involved in funding them if we don't know who their funders are?
Some of the corporations have come out. Some of their sponsorships have come out. We've also had a trove of internal documents from ALEC leak through the last years. We saw the Guardian newspaper late last year publish another group of documents. And what was most interesting about that is despite all the controversy surrounding this group when it comes to model legislation and their push on stand your ground laws that factored in the Trayvon Martin case, you know, despite all this and all the negative attention, its influence in North Carolina is actually growing, according to those documents. North Carolina is one of just seven states that saw their membership increase more than 40% in the last couple of years. And ALEC now counts 54 out of the 170 lawmakers as members.
They've been around since the early 70s, I understand. Why are they just now becoming known in public circles and just now beginning to, at least having an increase in their influence on public policy? What's going on?
As I mentioned, that Trayvon Martin case really brought this group to the forefront. ALEC used to have a much larger portfolio and support voter ID measures, support standard ground gun laws kind of thing. They've, since that instance and since the attention for them pushing this model legislation across the country, they've scaled it back mostly to economic issues. But what makes this group so interesting and controversial is that this model legislation concept where business interests and lawmakers are at the same table drafting legislation often to the benefit of those businesses. And we had an example here that emanated out of Minnesota, but it came up in the session last year where you had an asbestos company, a Philadelphia-based Crown Holdings, was trying to fight asbestos litigation against them in Minnesota, and they wrote a bill to protect themselves from lawsuits. And we saw that bill introduced here in North Carolina, though we have no direct linkage to this story. You know, the bill's sponsor, Jacqueline Schaefer, is a Charlotte Republican, and she wouldn't even explain kind of where this came from or what it was. But this bill had the North Carolina bill had identical language to the one in Minnesota and to one across the country.
Did it pass?
And it came up in a legislative committee last session.
Okay. Well, what are some of the possible the policies that they are, in fact, responsible for successfully pushing through the legislature in North Carolina? ALEC.
In analyzing legislation from last session, I found a handful of measures that were almost verbatim or at least include identical language to ALEC's model legislation, and at least 2,000 more bills that match the organization's priorities and intent. And this is wide-ranging, whether voter ID, allowing private school vouchers, to repealing the federal health care law, and prioritizing energy exploration. We saw it all over the place. A couple examples of bills that had identical language. Mm-hmm. There was an anti-union bill that was sponsored by Tom Tillis, who was named in 2011 as a ALEC Legislator of the Year.
He's a board
that
member.
Bill,
he's a board
yes,
member of ALEC.
He's a national board member now, yes. Mm-hmm. And House Bill 6 that he sponsored is very similar to an ALEC right-of-work measure, includes some of the same language. We saw what they called the Common Sense Consumption Act. This is a bill to protect food companies from lawsuits related to obesity and weight gain. That had identical language to the ALEC.
That's
measure.
The so-called.
And another one is a state sovereignty, in which the state asserting states' rights under the 10th Amendment had large portions that were identical to the ALEC resolution that said, you know, we must restate state sovereignty.
Chris, you cover a lot of different aspects of state government, and we just mentioned that House Speaker Tom Tillis, a Republican from this area, is the Speaker of the House, and he is a ALEC's 2011 Legislator of the Year and an ALEC's board member. Is there anything wrong with that? Is there any conflict of interest there at all?
Well, I think to understand, I mean, ALEC was largely formed as a business-backed group that was trying to take in its aim the regulations that they thought were too onerous for business at the state level, so environmental regulations, consumer protection. So I think as long as you understand what that backing means and who those donors are, and that's the hard thing is to really, as John found in his reporting, it's only because we've gotten access to internal documents that were unearthed that we understand the extent of corporate backing and who these donors are who are really forwarding backing this agenda. And the reason that's come out, as John said, is because so many 60 companies, 400 members have pulled out in the wake of this controversy and they're suffering a big budget deficit. But I think really what it gets to is this issue of transparency, which is something we're doing with our Follow NC Money project. The new money in politics landscape is that increasingly the agenda is driven by kind of these shadowy groups where they're not required to disclose their donors, although this is coming up for debate nationally in the Obama administration with the so-called C4 social welfare organizations, which have played such a big role. We're always been an advocate of trying to expand that disclosure. And I really want to point this out as one key issue that really has been defining in this is that the new crop of big money donors, one key point, one platform they've really pushed is to limit the disclosure of the money that's going into politics, and also to reverse campaign finance reforms that would limit their influence in policy. And so we saw in the last legislative session the killing of the public fund for judges, which would try to take out big money out of judicial races by providing a grant to judicial candidates. Widely supported, 80% of judicial candidates used it. Republicans, conservatives, they're not called that because they're nonpartisan races, but the conservatives and liberals. But it was a popular reform, had been around for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But Art Pope zeroed it out in his budget. Advocacy groups backed by Pope called for it being dismissed, dismantled. And then lawmakers that were backed by Pope, which that's an interesting situation with him being a budget director, negotiating with politicians that he helped elect in the legislature, right? Those people backed by Pope voting to take it down. And so what that did is now we have an environment where the role and the power of this money, many of it that we don't know the sources or where it's coming from, now has increased influence and ability to influence policy and politics.
So Bill Moyers on his program did a chart of this, and he talked about money coming from Washington, dark money, which means the money that they don't have to disclose the donors for, going to an organization which then funds another organization within the state of North Carolina, which then funds another organization which gives money to a judge who then becomes elected to the Supreme Court. And he would be the judge that would preside over voter complaints about influence of money on politics. So there's the voter becomes at a tremendous disadvantage, one would surmise, from that. One final question about the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. I had one former school board member here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg tell me back when we were talking about the influence of the legislature's decisions on public education, that a lot of the changes in the legislature's approach to public education here, many of which he felt were hurting or would hurt public education, were coming from ALEC. How involved have they been in the educational changes that the legislature has been deciding on?
Education is a major issue for ALEC. As I mentioned, ALEC pushes for private school vouchers. That's something we saw pass this legislature after not passing the session before. And lawmakers are already looking to expand it in future sessions. Another issue is charter schools. You know, North Carolina raised the cap a few years back, but the charter schools bill that would have created an independent board to manage them includes paragraphs that are near verbatim to ALEC's Charter School Growth and Quality Act. And that bill came to a full vote, and a version of it ended up passing, though not the full independent board. And if I can step back just real quickly and make a larger point about ALEC, some of these Art Pope-funded groups, and really just this conversation in general, is that when we talk about businesses influencing North Carolina politics, it's worth noting that corporate contributions are, for the most part, banned in North Carolina. And all these different entities and the funneling of money here and there, across state lines, up and down to D.C., it's all part of a way to get around that ban and allow businesses to have an influence in North Carolina that they cannot have directly by contributing to candidates.
Hmm. And is that going on in other states as well as ours, or just is that something special to North Carolina?
No, it's nationwide, and this is where the New York Times came in with a great piece on Sunday looking at this national network, and North Carolina factored into the story. This is some of the money that helped elect Republicans in 2010 and funds the same kind of campaigns all across the country. The story itself focused on Alabama, and this is all done through a group called the Republican Legislative Commission, and Phil Berger Jr. This is the Republican mm-hmm. State Leadership Committee.
State Leadership.
And Phil Berger Jr. here in North Carolina is a key leader in that group, too. So we definitely have some skin in the game here.
Okay, let's stop. We'll come back in just about 90 seconds with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Actors Theater of Charlotte, presenting Hedwig and the Angry Inch now through the 25th. This glam rock musical follows Hedwig, the rock goddess who fell victim to a botched sex change. Details at atcharlotte.com. Chemicals.org. Well, following last week's chemical spill, hundreds of thousands of West Virginians continue to live without safe running water. An update on the crisis and whether other states' water supplies are at risk. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to talk about politics and the influence of powerful people and money and organizations and businesses, now's your chance. Get on the line here at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And we are coming right back.
How'd you like to help this radio station and spiff up your driveway at the same time?
What are we doing? Going into the paving business once again?
No, it's Car Talk's new vehicle donation program where you donate a car. The proceeds benefit this station and you tuck it to the IRS at the same time.
Hat trick!
And you can do it all on the web. Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program.
Go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the influence of money and organizations in politics, particularly in North Carolina, but also around the country, with Jim Morrill, a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer, John Frank, a political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Chris Crum, publisher of Facing South and Southern Exposure, executive director for the Institute for Southern Studies. We have an email from Tom. I think it is disappointing, he writes, that in covering the Republican legislative takeover in general and Art Pope in particular, two of the panelists represent unabashedly liberal newspapers. Would you agree with that, John and Jim?
We're neutral.
Jim and I hear this all the time, and we actually hear the exact opposite as well, that we're unabashedly conservative.
Okay. Then you're doing your job.
Well, the product here is that Republicans are in power, so they get more attention. Right. We showered Democrats with attention when they're in power, helped both Charlotte and the NNO, did some amazing reporting that helped lead to Jim Black being indicted
Mike
on
Easley.
Campaign finance issues, Mike Easley. And we even covered Beth Perdue's troubles quite aggressively.
As did the Institute for Southern Studies, I might add.
And let me finish with Tom's email, where he accuses the two journalists here of being unabashedly liberal, working for unabashedly liberal newspapers. And the other panelist is from a left-of-center advocacy group. There are no panelists that represent a center-right perspective. Why are the only perspectives on the show from the left? Just the way the cookie crumbled in this case, we are working diligently to get Art Pope to join us by himself, as a matter of fact, on a future program, and I think we're going to have success with that, because apparently he wants to make himself available. He's making himself available to you, Chris Crum, this Sunday, if I'm not mistaken, on a station in Raleigh called Rush Radio, correct?
No, we were on a radio show a couple of years ago, but I would definitely welcome the opportunity in the future.
Oh. It was on your website.
Right. Yeah. Well, we had done a show before, so this isn't one that's coming up.
Right.
So it must have been one that we did before.
You need to get reword that paragraph on your website.
Sure. Well, I think that the bottom line is, you know, and we were definitely attacked when we were doing investigations into Democratic lawmakers in the previous administrations. And I think the bottom line, again, is what they were saying is, you know, we look at who has power, and I think money follows power, as Jim pointed out, and also money drives power. And so it's important to across the board. You look at some of these interests like tobacco and energy interests, I think, are two great examples. Healthcare would be another one where they spread their money around. They've definitely given to both sides of the aisle. But what you see now, which is unique, is an alignment of those interests along with this ideological money, which the facts clearly show has been benefiting the conservative side of the spectrum in terms of this election spending that's just not even close in terms of the arms race on that side. So I think you're kind of seeing a perfect storm of the traditional interests, which have always gone wherever who's in power to get have a voice and you know, make sure they have an ear in government, aligning with ideological money, which has definitely benefited the right in solidifying their power.
Mike emails both this Mike, me, and Jim mentioned that voters elected the legislators, but that's not really the story. North Carolina is actually a very purple state, neither strongly red nor blue. On Election Day in 2012, when North Carolinians voted with a slight majority to give Mitt Romney 15 electoral votes, they also cast more votes for Democratic congressional representatives than Republicans, and yet because of gerrymandering, North Carolina now has 9 Republicans in Congress and only 4 Democrats. A very similar phenomenon happened with the General Assembly, and yet Republicans own supermajorities in both the House and Senate. Say no, voters did not elect the legislators. So, no, voters, no, let me do this again. So, no, comma, voters did not elect the legislators so much as the legislators gerrymandered the votes of their choice. We kind of hit on this earlier in the program, did we not?
Well, there's no doubt that in 2010, that was the pivotal year, as John mentioned. And the people who were elected that year redrew the district.
Well,
they did the same thing Democrats had done before.
Yes, in 2000, the Democrats, because they were in the control of the legislature, also redrew the districts to favor Democrats. This is something that speaks not to Republicans or Democrats. It speaks to the system, does it not? I mean, the system needs to be changed.
Well, there are people that are advocating that. They're talking about bipartisan or nonpartisan redistricting commissions. And there's a group going around the state making that pitch to audiences. And, you know, that has had some traction in the legislature, but not enough.
The next race, I think, to be affected by money and politics in North Carolina, although there'll be smaller races, is going to be the Senate race. We're a nationally focused Senate race with the incumbent Democrat Kay Hagan being already there attack ads. They were centered around the Affordable Care Act and her supporting it, and it was capitalizing on the bungled rollout back in October and November and December. This isn't particular to this state, but it's happening everywhere where the GOP sees a vulnerability with an incumbent Democratic senator. So what organizations are behind these ads? Who's funding them, do we know?
Well, Americans for Prosperity is one group that's advertising against Kay Hagan, and I think John, correct me, but they spent at least $4.5 million on TV ads already. And this is arguably the biggest state to attract outside money so far for a Senate race. She's one of a handful of races in the country that's really competitive and that Republicans really believe they can get. On the other hand, a Democratic group, too, the Senate Majority Fund, is helping Kay Hagan.
And that's, headed by Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader?
By people associated with Harry Reid. And I think George Soros just contributed a lot of money to that particular group.
So George Soros on the national level is Art Pope. Art Pope has been called a junior Koch brothers. They're the right-leaning George Soros. Mm. What is there a difference between George Soros and the Koch brothers and Art Pope, really? I mean, they're all rich. They're using their money to advance their own political agendas and what they truly believe in their heart. Is there a difference?
Well, I would say, again, I'd point to one defining difference that we've seen in our analysis over the years. I mean, we've been around since 1970 tracking the money on both sides and the undue influence and the corrupting influence that money has had on both sides. So we definitely have an even-handed look at this. But one defining issue where I do think there's a difference is that a lot of the donors on the liberal side, when they get to issue advocacy, have been on the side of campaign finance reform, basically changes to the election system in ways that would decrease and diminish their ability to influence politics. And I think that is a substantive difference when you look at the right and the left money that's come into politics. I think on the electoral side, it's very easy to say you can look at any given race and find an imbalance or where money is benefiting one side or the other, like in North Carolina with the Republican advantage in recent years. But I think when you get to the issue side, that's a pretty big difference in that you see groups like Soros that he backs have advocated changes to election law that would increase disclosure of campaign finance money and would also find reforms like the clean election reform in North Carolina, which was partially killed this year or entirely killed actually for canceled state and judicial races, finding solutions like that on a national level, which would limit the influence of money in politics. I think that's a real substantive difference. But when it gets to money in politics and electing people, it seems like all bets are off there.
Is the influence of money in politics using this dark money, which became available to politicians and to support groups on the left and right as a result of Citizens United, any different than what we've been talking about for years, where we talked about the fact that an elected official's second job, but perhaps his first job, is raising money? I think somebody reported that 90 minutes or 2 hours of every congressperson's day is spent on the phone raising money. Is there any difference in being beholden to those who you're asking actively for money versus the money you're getting from these organizations through back channels?
Mike, the question we look at in analyzing campaign finance data is we look at a number of factors. One, who's doing the giving and where did it come from, as we've talked about corporate contributions or other business industry contributions. But it's also a factor of how much. A number of states have low contribution limits that are maybe $250, $500. And other states like us have larger limits. And the federal level is obviously larger in the context of that Senate race. How much they give is essentially a proxy for how much access you have generally in politics. And that's why we focus so much attention on the money in politics, because traditionally it buys you access. It gives you face time. It gives you a platform to make your case that maybe the average voter who doesn't give money doesn't always have. And that's the general premise that we explore this from. And it's Democrats and Republicans. I may be a little more cynical than Chris. I don't know that Democrats' money is a little more altruistic than Republicans. You saw Democrats in Minnesota, as the New York Times reported, funnel money from all across the country to unseat some Republican lawmakers and overturn the state's ban on gay marriage. And now Minnesota allows gay marriage. And you're going to see Democrats try to do that here in North Carolina, hold on to Kay Hagan's seat. The Senate Majority PAC just got millions from Michael Bloomberg to help push those races. And we saw outside groups come in and try to help Walter Dalton in the governor's race in 2012 through the Democratic Governors Association, which is a 527, which has a lot more lenient campaign finance requirements on it. And they funneled some of that money down here that those same people wouldn't have been able to give Dalton. So we're seeing it all over the place.
If we went back to Andrew Jackson or to Abraham Lincoln or to Teddy Roosevelt, to bring it into more modern times, Woodrow Wilson in the 20th century, would we have and their contemporaries in the Congress and the legislatures of their times, would we have seen the same kind of influence, or were voters in control then? We don't seem to be in control anymore. When did the influence of money really begin to be what it is today?
Well, this is Chris. I think there's a little bit of a myth of a golden age when money didn't play a role in politics. And I think that, you know, the stories of bribery and corruption that we've seen, and it's really because of past instances of corruption that led to reforms like we saw during the Watergate era, which increased disclosure that people and donors had to list who their employer was, so you knew actually where the money was coming from, disclosure requirements. I think what is changing now is that there's been a pretty much steady reversal over the last 10 years of a lot of these reforms that were enacted to try to bring greater light and exposure to the influence and the ways that money influences politics. And again, I think a real substantive issue is like what happened in this last legislative session, where disclosure has been decreased. There's been an increase on the contribution limits. There's no more public financing or clean elections. Those are reversals. And I think it's going to be only time will tell exactly what that means. But in the short term, we know going into this election season, we're going to know less about what money is coming into the state and how it's trying to influence the policy in the state because of those changes.
Let me take a couple of very quick calls from listeners who've been hanging on for a while. And I will begin with David in Charlotte. David, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. And to your guest. Yes, I think the voters need to decide countrywide, not just here in North Carolina, whether or not you're going to be a Grapes of Rather or a Atlas Shrugger. Grapes of Rather, meaning government is there to help you and to control bad influences, and Atlas Shruggers, meaning no government or little government, except when it comes to regulating a woman's reproduction act.
That kind of sums up the struggle, doesn't it? That's a pretty good analogy.
And Mike, one other thing, I wish you'd do a story on Lewis Powell's memo from 8/23/1971. This is all of your right wing organizations were basically born out of that. ALEC, Heritage Foundation, and the American Enterprise Institute.
All right. Are you guys familiar with that at all? Not at all? Okay. Well, thank you for your call, but I think it's a good analogy about Grapes of Wrath versus Atlas Shrugged, which, of course, is the Ayn Rand novel, which is the libertarian Bible, it seems to me, in many cases. John in Charlotte, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Thank you. I wondered what your guest see on the Democratic side as a way to meet the outside money. I understand that Jim Hunt is in the process of trying to put together a much more significant Democratic response. And secondly, what do you think as the challenge to the current redistricting moves from the state Supreme Court to the federal court?
Who wants to take that? Anybody?
I can speak to the first part of the question. Democrats are definitely trying to muster the power to match Republican forces on this one. Being out of power does not help. When it comes to the Senate race, they're likely to have the advantage, though, because Democrats control the Senate, at least for the moment, and Kay Hagan's seat may be one of those two or three that decides if it stays in Democratic control. So you're going to see Democrats really coalesce and focus on that Senate race. They have not been able to form the kind of networks that conservatives and Republicans have to take control of the legislature and really push their agenda there, but they're trying, that's for sure.
The districts that the legislature drew, the legislative districts in 2010 are in the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court right now, which is still debating that. But a three-judge panel of Democratic judges, a lower court panel, supported and endorsed the district. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to see that they would change.
Should we be disturbed that an Art Pope who has funneled a great deal of his personal fortune into getting his political ideas through and having them have heft and weight and influence, should we be disturbed that he's also the budget director, working within the government and without?
Well, as I alluded to, this is Chris, I think the situation we saw in the last legislative session where as a representative of the governor's office, for someone in that position to be negotiating with lawmakers that had received definitely the bulk of the outside spending that benefited their campaigns, helped put them in the office. He's now negotiating with them over these issues.
And Chris,
I think raises.
Go ahead, finish your sentence.
Oh, go ahead. It creates a serious conflict, okay. And we saw that on several issues. But it's an unusual situation. I can't think of a parallel nationally.
And you would say that if he were on the left as well?
Absolutely.
Okay. Chris Crum is publisher of Facing South, Southern Exposure, and executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies. He joined us from a studio at WUNC in Durham, along with John Frank, a political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. In our studio, Jim Morrill, political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all, gentlemen, for the hour.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks.